Okay. Okay. Good afternoon. I'll announce my talk. Here's the title, and I enjoy the relaxing atmosphere here. So I'll try to talk in the same style that is accepted in this warm climate. So what I'll be talking about is some theory and actually a sequence of experiments that were done mostly at Saclay, which I think built reasonably interesting and to an extent complete picture of the effect of magnetic impurities in normal metals, how they act upon the energy relaxation of electrons. So to set the stage, I'll first discuss briefly the conventional theory of energy relaxation in Fermi liquid just due to the Coulomb interaction between electrons. And then I'll discuss how the magnetic impurities, which may be present in the metal, affect the equilibration. And finally, I guess if you're not bored towards the end of the talk, I'll tell about more detailed characterization of the inelastic electron scattering of magnetic impurities. So, first of all, if you want to ask a question about the equilibration, the first thing comes to mind is just to write the Boltzmann equation and see how initially non-equilibrium distribution of electrons will relax in time. And for that, we just write collision integral. And this second and third line are just the Fermi-Golden rule, basically telling that electrons collide and the probabilities of transition depend on the occupations of the initial and final states. So F are the distribution functions. And having the collision integral, one can introduce the energy relaxation time, 1 over tau, which basically knows about the kernel, about the probability of collision of two particles with energy transfer E. Okay, so KFE has simple physical meaning of the rate of transitions in two particle collisions in which the particles exchange energy E between themselves. So this relation between 1 over tau and K follows simply from the phase space arguments. If we look at our electron with energy epsilon and want it to relax, it must fall down to some energy above the Fermi level. And on the other hand, electrons that receives the energy must start below the Fermi level and end above the Fermi level. So these two integrals are basically ensuring that what happens to the receiving electron. And this is a relation between 1 over tau and K. So in terms of the power counting, 1 over tau has two extra powers of energy compared to the collision integral, to the kernel of the collision integral. So if 1 over tau, for example, depends as energy squared on energy, it means that collision integral kernel, KFE, is energy independent. And that's just the, if you open the text on theory of metals, that's basically the main thing why Fermi liquid is good in description of metals, is that because the lifetime of a particle close to the Fermi level is large. It scales as 1 over energy squared, where energy is measured from the Fermi level. And that's just by merely by the fact of the phase space available for scattering. So that's a conventional theory for clean metals. So for clean metals, basically, K is energy independent, as we saw. If metals are dirty, if a metal is dirty, then the main change comes from the fact that P, momentum, is not a good quantum number anymore, so energies are still there, but we can't characterize state of a particle by momentum. And this theory was also worked out in details in late 70s by Schmidt, Altshuler, and Aronoff in independent, more or less independent papers. And the main idea, physical idea, is that if electrons scatter off impurities, then they have harder time to separate. So if they meet, they spend some time together. And therefore, the collision integral kernel is enhanced. And the smaller the energy, the stronger the enhancement, because if electrons don't exchange energy, they stay longer close to each other. It's very poor explanation by hand-waving argument, but the calculation is pretty straightforward. It was done long ago, and basically here is the expression for the collision interval kernel as a function of energy. And now it's clear that it should depend on the dimensionality of the system, whether we're talking about 3D, 2D, or a wire 1D system. KFE will have different energy dependence. So just again, by simple power counting, you can see that the kernel KFE depends on energy, on the transferred energy E is e to power d over 2 minus 2, where d is dimension 1 to 3. And that means that the relaxation rate 1 over tau scales as epsilon to power d over 2. So for a wire, so what is 1D wire? It's not really 1D in terms of quantum wires that we are used in this audience. Well, most of us, I guess, used. Not you. here, 1D is in terms of metallic 1D. So the number of modes is huge. It's 1D in the sense that electron very fast diffusing across the wire, but it takes a long time to diffuse along. So basically, in terms of diffusion, it's 1D diffusion. And in this case, the kernel scales as energy to power minus 3 halves, and the scattering rate scales as energy electron to power 1 half when energy epsilon is measured from the Fermi level. So the thing that I would like to emphasize here is that the scattering rate gets smaller at smaller energies. The lifetime of a state is infinitely increasing at energy going to zero. I'm cheating a little bit here, and I'm telling that the signature of Fermi liquid actually is not entirely true, because for Fermi liquid you need that that the relaxation time scales even faster with energy, as epsilon to power larger than 1. But if you take into account all the prefactors, it turns out that in the region of validity of this formula, the state is very well defined, and epsilon tau is large. This comforting thing that tau is diverging when epsilon goes to zero is good for Fermi liquid description. Well, the theory existed for a long time, but to measure tau epsilon, it's very hard, because basically you have to go inside the metal and somehow to see how the electrons are distributed. Metals are reflecting light, as you know, so it's very hard to get into the metal even with a photon. I would say experimental breakthrough was made around 97 by a Saclay group. On microscopic samples, on thin wires, where they were able to attach a probe made of a superconductor, which has a very sharp density of states, and by tunneling measurements, infer the distribution function. And there was very interesting motivation to do this, which I'll completely skip. It's related to noise and some problems in the noise, just shut noise intensity. How it depends on various parameters. So that was the motivation for this experiment, but the bottom line is that it brought very surprising result. So, namely, it allowed experimentalists to see that the collision interval kernel, which I discussed, and which may go up at low energies, goes up at low energies, but even faster than one expects. So for 1D wire, I mentioned, you expect 1 over epsilon to 3 halves. And what they observed is that actually it diverges as 1 over epsilon squared. And again, I'll skip the details how they do it, how they do the measurements, but basically there is one very simple signature. You may try to scale all the data for different biases applied to wire in terms of F and energy divided by bias. The collapsing of curves on one curve indicates this dependence of the kernel, 1 over epsilon squared. And that's basically, you can see it already at the level of analyzing the Boltzmann equation for the distribution function. Basically, it becomes homogeneous in epsilon. So that's pretty robust signature of this strong divergence, and it is it caused some, I would say, uproar in the kinetic theory community, at least in part of kinetic theory community, because basically the statement is that 1 over tau epsilon doesn't vanish at zero energy. No matter how you slice it, this kind of integral that takes into account the phase space volume and the dependence on energy of the collision integral will behave poorly at small energies. And that perhaps means that if I just take it at phase value, that 1 over tau doesn't go to zero when energy goes to zero. So by no means a quasi-particle is a well-defined object near the Fermi level, which is bad for everything that we know about metals. Now about as to numbers, here's all dimensionality is taken into account. This kernel KFE is basically this 1 over epsilon squared, 1 over energy squared with a prefactor tau naught, which is about 1 nanosecond. Now, interesting thing about this paper, when preparing today, I looked through it again. If you read on which materials, the title is just metals. And then somewhere toward the end of first page, you discover it's copper. But it's not an abstract, so it looked very general. And that was actually, I recall the feeling in 97 that, okay, that's just the law of nature. So, but it's so strongly contradicted the conventional wisdom, and actually knowledge, that people started to look at some artifacts. And one of the things that were looked first was the question about the way the distribution function was measured. As I mentioned, to measure the distribution function, what they did basically, they attached a superconducting lead here, probe, this green thing here. And the superconductor has a very sharp peak in the resistive states, as we know. And if you apply some bias between the wire and if you bias the probe with some voltage, that allows you to scan the distribution function at this voltage or energy EV. That is the main idea behind this measurement. So having sharp peak is good for scanning distribution function. And the question was whether somehow when you induce non-equilibrium state in a wire, it somehow degrades the property of this measuring device, and that's why basically this measurement is not reliable. So there was a very detailed and nice, actually, in various respects, paper of Narozhny and Altshuler. The idea was that because a normal metal is driven out of equilibrium, the density of state in the gap becomes finite. So instead of this sharp edge, what you develop is something quite smooth, and therefore you lose the resolution with which you measure, which allows you to measure the distribution function. So their idea was that maybe the broadening of BCS singularity density of states looks like broadening of the distribution function and gives the wrong result about 1 over tau. But almost immediately there was another experiment that actually told that perhaps there is no problem in this context. And here's the experiment. So here this question about materials comes in again. The first experiment was done on copper and then it was on silver. And silver it was a textbook thing. So for silver wire, first of all, Patia et al. Saw that there is no collapse of data in this magic variables, energy over bias. The curves don't collapse on one. And then they just went ahead and basically solved the Boltzmann equation for wire of given lengths. We were able to see that the best fit to the collision integral kernel is indeed a power law, epsilon to power minus alpha. This alpha equals 3/2, just as prescribed. So apparently the technique works, and that's a question about material, what material one uses. So it becomes, I guess, less fundamental, but still, so what's so special about copper? I guess we don't know till today. But then they tried other materials as well, and by, I don't remember precisely the month, but somewhere in 2000, there was this map. So silver behaved as prescribed. Copper and gold behaved in a strange way. They refined experiments, and actually with gold they were able to do beautiful data collapse for wires of different lengths. So by that time, actually, we got some idea, and when I saw this graph, we called Hugh Patia and asked about what about resistance. So these wires actually are short, so you can't measure resistance. In the same operations, they had long wires, and their collaborator Norman Birch from Michigan State actually did measure resistance as a function of temperature. And just in a few days, I got this nice email, which actually I think I'm using your ideas about putting emails on the on the viewers. Was accompanying this plot. So basically, what they found looking at the temperature dependence of resistance is that there is a term which comes from the electron-electron interaction, but there is a logarithmic term which is quite typical for the Kanda effect in low temperature resistivity of materials with magnetic impurities. So for whatever reason, gold apparently wasn't that clean. And then actually, if one tries to extract the constant in front of log t, we know that it should be proportional to the density of magnetic impurities if it's Kanda effect. Then one can calibrate the unknown sample by having samples where the density of impurities is known, and that's what they did, and found that in this original measurements of the energy relaxation on gold wires, apparently there was a significant density of magnetic impurities, about 50 parts per million. So that, to some extent, explained the resistivity data. And I will tell a bit later how it explains the energy relaxation data. But first, again, because I guess there are different backgrounds for people in the audience, so I'll just remind very quickly about Kanda effect. So basically, it was observed by a number of people, and it's just one of the observations, I think the cleanest one, by de Haas. So the striking thing is that at low temperatures, resistivity goes up instead of going down to some saturation value. And the surprise of the resistivity at low temperatures was kind of a mystery for about 30 years, when Kanda tried to look at the scattering cross-section of magnetic impurity in higher orders in the perturbation theory. So he assumed that the interaction of electron with impurity is local, just by exchange, and then evaluated a correction to resistivity coming from next after the Born approximation level. And on the schematic level, basically what he did, he looked at scattering of an electron, this red line, of an impurity, this is word line of impurity, of magnetic impurity, twice. And there are two various ways to do it. And that actually brought this log term in the resistivity. So I'll dwell a little bit more on details. So in the Born approximation, if I take this Hamiltonian, it's local Hamiltonian, in Born approximation, scattering amplitude is just proportional to the interaction constant, J naught. Okay? And the scattering cross-section will be J naught squared. And scattering, of course, is elastic, right? Because basically there is no energy to transfer to spin. It flips up and down without any energy expense. So scattering is elastic. Now, in the next order, what Kanda realized that there are, two contributions. I would say one is electron-like, another one is hole-like. This one can be represented schematically by the following picture. So I have a spin and electron, and then upon collision, the electron goes to some virtual state. So energy is not conserved when going from here to here. And then it collides with the same impurity, magnetic impurity again, and ends up in some real state. So it's just typical second-order process with virtual state. But then there is another term where what happens is that in the virtual state, in addition to our initial electron, there is electron hole pair. So this electron hole pair can be produced in two states, in a triplet state and in a singlet state. So you see, for each electron-like process, there are two hole-like processes. And this is the origin of this coefficient 2. And that's the difference between an impurity that has internal degree of freedom, spin, from just elastic scattering of a potential impurity. For potential impurity, there would be no factor of 2. I can do the same thing. In second order, I'll get also two terms, but they'll happily cancel each other. There'll be no any logarithmic disaster like it happens here. And here it happens because there is degree of freedom, the spin may flip. So basically that leads to logarithmically divergent scattering amplitude divergent at low energy epsilon, where energy epsilon is electron energy measured from the Fermi level. And what's important though, that we had in the beginning an electron and an impurity, and in the end we have one electron and one impurity. So basically the energy belonging to electron is preserved, and the scattering remains elastic. So the amplitude changes, and actually changes drastically because there is this log correction, but the scattering remains elastic. So that was basically the calculation of Konda. It didn't matter for him that it's elastic. It still contributes to resistivity. Now that can be improved, and I'll build it a little bit more later, but basically one can go and try to sum up leading logarithmic series looking for higher orders in exchange interaction corrections, but keeping the most divergent in logarithmic sense terms. And summation of these terms actually can be abbreviated to the following simple statement, that just take Born approximation and then replace J naught by some effective J, which is energy dependent. It depends on energy as 1 over log epsilon over Tk, where a new scale appears, Tk, Konda temperature, that depends on the bare interaction strength of the impurity with conduction electrons. So basically, if I look at the result for the correction to the resistivity, we see that first of all that the correction becomes large when energy or temperature, as it becomes the order of Konda temperature. In this region, the scattering cross-section of electron of an impurity reaches something of order of the Fermi wavelengths. So basically, the scattering cross-section goes up when energy of electron goes down. At energy of order of Konda temperature, there is a crossover to what is called unitary limit. A point like impurity cannot scatter stronger than an how to say it better. So the cross-section of a point like impurity cannot get bigger than Fermi wavelength squared, right? So basically, if we have a point like impurity, then the typical size, quote-unquote, of a scatter is the wavelength of the particle that is impinging. So that basically lambda f squared is the maximal cross-section, and it's reached when energy becomes order of tk. It's almost reached when energy becomes order of tk. But what's important is that in this approximation, it looks like scattering remains elastic all the way. We don't see any inelastic processes. We start with one electron, we end with one electron, and no energy is transferred to spin because there is no way for spin to get energy. It's the flip doesn't change the spin energy as long as there is no magnetic field. Well, experimentally, actually, one can check that the correction of course saturates. There is no any divergence. We have logarithmic tail, but it doesn't diverge when T is equal to Tk. This low temperature behavior actually can be captured by a picture which Nazir developed for low temperature and of the Konda problem. And again, skipping details and beautiful, actually beautiful details, I'll just tell the very end of the story. So basically, at low energies, what happens is that one screens the spin of an impurity and the residual interactions of electrons that are scattered from this compound state, impurity plus neutralizing, well, plus the compensating spin. This residual interaction can be expressed via two terms. Basically, it tells that there is elastic scattering if energy is away from the Fermi level. So if epsilon is not zero, then this term is not zero. And there is inelastic scattering term, but this inelastic scattering is at one point, at the point of impurity. So having this second term, electron-electron interaction, basically, local electron-electron interaction, we understand that there must be inelastic scattering. And basically this term, just again by the phase space argument, tells me that at low energies, inelastic cross-section must behave as energy squared. Okay, so now we are coming to some kind of discrepancy. If I start with low energy theory and try to approach energy order of quantum temperature, then I will see that inelastic scattering cross-section of the inelastic cross-section and elastic cross-sections are the same order, and they are both about Fermi wavelengths squared. Okay, so that's when I come from the lower end and use the fixed point theory. On the other hand, if I use the leading log approximation, I'll see that approaching the same energy scale, epsilon order of tk, from above, it looks like there is no inelastic scattering, and that is impossible because there is no any kind of phase transition or any strong energy dependence or peculiar energy dependence of cross section. So something is incorrect. Well, in my conclusion, something is incorrect, and as you'll see in a second, actually, it's not true that inelastic cross section is zero at high energies. It's just the approximation that makes it zero, but there are other terms in scattering cross sections that make scattering inelastic at any energy. And so this is basically the one view graph, which is the main part of the main physics part of the discussion. So I suggest just to follow on a very simple model how the energy is transferred between two electrons in the presence of a magnetic impurity. Okay, so I simplified Hamiltonian. Initially, I had isotropic SE2 invariant exchange interaction, but I arbitrarily chosen some X as Z and thrown away term as Z as Z, and I look at some toy model where there is a local spin which can flip up, down, operator is plus and minus, and there are just two electrons. So instead of Fermi C, I left only two electrons in the system. At momentum states, P and P prime, and spins down and up. Okay, so I have only three particles. Impurity, electron number one, and number two. Right, and now what I want to calculate is the scattering amplitude from this state to some other state. And I will do it in the second order of the perturbation theory, just looking at standard T-matrix expansion in the interaction V-toy. So I start with a state, and I apply this operator V. So now I see that if I want to change the state, I have to kill both these guys, right? If I want to look at somewhere, at some process where both states are changed. But I have this state P with spin down, and there is only one way to kill it, right? So I have to pair this annihilation operator with this state P down. Then I apply the resolvent, and then I have to apply another perturbation V. And now I have a possibility to kill this guy by this annihilation operator, right? So as a result, I killed both P and P prime states. I created state P3 at the first stage, and I created state P1 at the second stage. So I'll get a wave function which has, instead of P and P prime electrons, it'll have P3 and P1 electrons, so different states. And the amplitude is proportional to the energy difference between state P and P3. So at the first step, I killed electron with momentum P and create electron with momentum P3. So the energy difference is psi P minus psi P3. And here is a process that actually does allow to change, to redistribute energy between the two electrons. Okay, nobody told me that P must be equal to P3. And I see that indeed I do change the states, the energies of the two states. So this model is good in the following sense. I have to emphasize that there is only one way to pair here. There is only one way to contract. So I'm sure that there is no any other term that will interfere with this one and cancel it. Now, if you want to exercise, you can do the same thing for potential scattering. And you'll see that they'll beautifully kill each other, the terms that are coming from pairing in two different ways. So it's really important that there is this internal degree of freedom, the spin, that basically tells me in which order I have to apply the contractions. So that basically in the this is an incipient answer to the question. So now if I calculate the scattering cross-section, I'll find that indeed it scales as 1 over energy squared, where E is transferred in the collision energy. And then you can dress it properly, summing over the initial states, summing over the final states, averaging over the initial states. And of course, it doesn't change 1 over square dependence, but it also gives some expression for the interaction, for the constant in front of 1 over squared. So that's just the lowest order perturbation theory calculation. So again, using your ideas about showing pictures. So basically, if you look at anomalous behavior of inelastic scattering instead of anomalous behavior of metallic resistivity, what happens is that you may try to collapse the data, and all this stuff can be explained by considering not these two diagrams, but just one of this type. That's indeed the solution, maybe a solution of the puzzle. Now, again, one should try to improve. So the problem is actually with this idea was that if you put in numbers, the cross section one gets is quite a bit lower than the observed, and I would say that it remains kind of a lingering problem. So. One thing that should be improved is that actually these bare vertices that correspond to interaction of an electron with impurity can be dressed in the way the usual conda dressing in leading log is done, which I alluded a little bit before. And that amounts to replacement of the bare interaction constants with some logarithmically renormalized. Again, I will not dwell on this too much. There are good and bad things about that. So the good thing is that actually that dramatically increases the cross-section, because basically instead of the bare interaction J0, you're getting something that knows about quanta temperature, and if energy epsilon is not million times but only 30 times larger than quanta temperature, then this log is not such a terrible beast, and the interaction constant is not that small. So this is a good thing. Bad thing that actually destroys nice scaling, because the kernel depends not only on energy, on transferred energy E now, but also on the energies of the scattering electrons, epsilon, epsilon prime. So that's the bad part of story. However, again, the dependence on epsilon, epsilon prime is relatively smooth. It's only logarithmic. And the experiment is done in such a way that you have to integrate over epsilon, epsilon prime anyway. So apparently, the dependence is weak enough in order to replace in the kernel this energy is epsilon epsilon prime by some characteristic energy which is given by the external bias by U. So that's basically was one of the attempts to explain the experiment quantitatively. There are some further improvements, which I will not discuss, done by Gerpert and by Hans Kroha, which tried basically to use some numerical procedures to go to energies, to biases even closer to quanta temperature. That, I think that this approximation numerically is good when bias is about 30 times, 20, 30 times above TK or larger. And they tried to push it down a bit. I'm not able to judge how good are the approximations they're using, but if you look at numbers, so basically, so now what is this impurity in gold? It's also an interesting story, because this original experiments on conda effect by de Haas were done on very clean gold that was available at that time, but it turns out that it's very hard to get iron out of the gold. So any reasonable, not specially prepared gold would have lots of iron. And basically what the Sclater group used in the beginning was the gold that indeed had just a usual impurity of iron there. So, but for iron and gold, the quantum temperature is known. It's about 0.3 Kelvin. So basically, the bias which should be applied should be about 20 times larger than 30 microvolts, and that's about the region of bias I use in experiments. So it's not inconceivable that that explains the experiment even quantitatively. However, well, there are two things that should be looked at. One is purely theoretical thing, so this divergence at low energies, whether it's true or not. And of course, it's not true because this is the artifact of the lowest order perturbation theory. What happens is that basically, if I look at very small transferred energies, it means that these two electrons must stay without two electrons and spin must stay without any loss of coherence for a long time, for a time of order of 1 over E. And there is a very simple mechanism which is called Karinger relaxation that works against it. So the spin of impurity can flip just because of attraction with other electrons. And that cuts off the singularity 1 over E squared. And the cutoff actually occurs at scale of order of H bar over Karinger time. And one can check, it's pretty straightforward, that this energy cutoff is much smaller than the applied bias. So basically, for any interval that we need an experiment, that they need an experiment, indeed, this expression should be good. But another thing which is more interesting, I think, is that to try to see what happens if you tweak the experiment. So the idea was that if you apply magnetic field, just due to Zeeman splitting, you block the spin flips, right? So then I would expect the following thing, that if I apply a bias less than Zeeman splitting, then this mechanism will be paralyzed because there will be not enough energy to flip the spin. And if I apply bias larger than the Zeeman splitting, then the mechanism involving magnetic impurities will be enhanced because there you don't need even two electrons to scatter in the vicinity of a spin. You just take one electron, scatter off the spin, of localized spin, and you lose energy equal to Zeeman energy. So what one may expect that there is suppression of the collisions at bias less than Zeeman and enhancement at bias larger than Zeeman. And it can be worked out in all glory details. And it was worked out in a very nice paper of Goeppert, Yuri Galperin and Boris Altschuler. And here's the experiment. So what is shown here is the color is the intensity of energy relaxation. Horizontal axis is magnetic field, vertical is applied bias, and as you see, the colors are kind of blue-green for bias less than Zeeman energy and more reddish for bias above, signaling the higher rate of scattering. One can look at how the distribution functions, which must be just two-step function if there is no relaxation, degrades because of scatterings. And indeed, you see that for small biases and large fields, there is kind of two-step structure in the distribution function. And at higher biases, it gets smeared. That was repeated on with better control on gold samples. And again, the same story for small bias and large field, very sharp step. For large bias and zero field, it degrades. And then there was another, I would say, just fantastic experiment by Norman Birch that have shown that indeed there are fluctuating magnetic impurities in the sample. So he made a copper ring and then looked at Aronoff-Bohm effect. So in Aronoff-Bohm effect, basically, you look at coherent the interference of electrons that are moving along two arms and produce just interference pattern when you change flux through the loop. So if there are magnetic impurities in these two arms, then interference will be suppressed because basically electrons that are passing through upper and lower loop and meet here, they may already forget about the initial spin. And that basically what is seen indeed, that the oscillations of the resistance with magnetic field are pretty small. But then what he did, he applied strong field, such a field that presumably blocks the fluctuations of magnetic impurities. And then at strong fields, suddenly, well, not suddenly, but gradually, the amplitude of oscillations, around the oscillations, is increasing. So basically, the experiment showed that if one assumes that there are magnetic impurities in the sample, then it can be explained easily. The effect can be explained easily. When you apply a strong magnetic field, you block fluctuations of magnetic impurities, and you restore Aronofsky interference for electrons that are passing through the two parts of the loop. And actually, from this kind of experiment, you can try to extract G factor. And there are actually some problems with fitting this G factor to well, to poorly known G factor of impurities in copper, which are perhaps are oxygen to the surface, but that's still an open question. So at least there are three kinds of experiments. First is tau epsilon, just in the epsilon magnetic field. Second, it's tau epsilon in the presence of Zeeman splitting, which shows a big difference between relaxation of energetic electrons and low energy electrons. And then the third experiment is this interference experiment that all point towards magnetic impurities be present in these samples. Now, they did another series of, I think, quite well-controlled experiments of silver doped with manganese. And there was a work where they looked at energy distribution. Basically, it repeats these ideas that I already discussed, how the relaxation depends on magnetic field. And a bit later, on the same type of samples, they looked at the relocalization and were able to extract the phase relaxation time, which also depends on the magnetic impurities. It's very well worked out theory back in mid-80s. So basically, one can try to extract the spin, the phase relaxation constant coming from spin flips, and one can extract this T naught, tau naught constant that comes into the anomalous energy relaxation. These both constants depend on the density of magnetic impurities, NS, and depend on the interaction, kinetic interaction of electrons with impurities. And what one can check is that indeed Zeeman effect does influence relaxation, so this check went through. The functional form of the kernel also was confirmed, but then you may try to look at the constants. NS, the density of impurities, is known because it was just implanted impurities that they were able to control. And then there's only one parameter, J nu, that is in the game. And one can try to compare this J nu from two experiments, and that doesn't agree very well. So as far as I understand, there are two problems. And already after that paper, what I've kind of heard is that part of the reason comes from the uncertainties in the, well, actually not uncertainties, but some very simple problem with electromagnetic contribution to tau phi. So it turns out that the correct coefficient in the electromagnetic contribution to tau phi was basically fixed. The coefficient was fixed a couple of years ago. And if you take this fixed, in a good sense, fixed value of the constant, you get actually a better agreement between J nu found from two expressions. But there is another problem, which is, I guess, beyond numerical errors, is that, as I described, basically, the way they measure tau naught comes from looking at non-equilibrium distributions of electrons, heavily non-equilibrium distributions of electrons. And then there is this question about intrinsic logarithmically divergent functions. So it would be nice, actually, to have some cleaner experiment just to try to see what happens with one electron that you throw into otherwise equilibrium metal and look how it relaxes. So in principle, this kind of experiment can be done by modification of the original experiment if one introduces a tunnel barrier between the lead and the metal and just inject a very small number of non-equilibrium electrons and then watch how they behave. Okay, so basically you don't disturb the entire community of electrons by injected current. So the idea is that if you have tunnel barriers, then you inject only a few electrons. So this peak of the distribution function at small energies is tiny. And then you watch how it evolves, this progressing either time or distance. And from this degrading of this initial peak, one can one can judge indeed how the electrons, how the probe electron is scattered inelastically. Turns out that this kind of a layout exists, but it was used for something else. I discovered it serendipitously, but well, again, it's from the same group, and they use it for something else. But I guess something like that will work, may work for the idea, the discussed idea of the experiment. So here, the quantities that one hopefully can measure and the quantities that can be calculated is a cross section, is a differential cross section of inelastic scattering. So basically, it's a probability of scattering of electron with initial energy U and with energy transfer omega. Right? So I have electrons that comes in with energy U, and then it scatters losing energy omega, and I'm asking what is the probability to be scattered in interval d omega with the loss of energy omega. So this quantity sigma of U and omega actually can be defined in some limit. And I don't know a general definition. So I will just tell in which limit I think I can work with this quantity. So for that, we have to revisit the scattering problem. So basically, the way I view the problem is the following thing, that I have a conda impurity completely screened, say we are at zero temperature and there is no dangling spin, it's fully screened by the electrons, and then I shoot another particle, okay? So initial state is a direct product of my electron state at energy E and conda polaron, and it goes into some final state. Now, if this energy E is way high, well above the conda temperature, then I can approximate this final state by a state of one electron that changed energy from E to E prime and excited conda polaron. So basically, my electron lost some energy, but as long as E minus E prime is much less than initial energy E, I still can distinguish between the hot electron, which is well above the state that formed conda polaron, and the excited state of the conda polaron. So this energy result scattering cross-section is well-defined, I believe, only in the case if the initial energy is large compared to the conda temperature, and if the transferred energy is small compared to the initial energy. So in this regime, I can develop a perturbative scheme to evaluate sigma. Now, I think it has some philosophical meaning, because it gets me back to the question whether the electron scattering is elastic or not at high energies, right? So if you recall this story about the leading log, I mean, for leading log approximation, it doesn't matter whether I'm talking about energy or temperature, and it looks like scattering is elastic at high energies. And actually, I do know that it's not elastic. So I just wonder how much, in which sense it's not elastic at high energies. And that's basically the question about how sigma depends on omega at energies E well above the conda temperature. So if I look at large energy transfers compared to conda temperature, then I can just imagine that, well, not imagine, but can show that by scattering of a conda polaron, I excite a single electron hole pair. So upon scattering, my electron loses energy omega. This energy is deposited as energy electron hole pair. And one can one can evaluate quite easily the cross section. But now if omega is small, then what happens that a scattered electron leaves lots of electron hole excitations behind. And this is a harder problem. But as long as energy E is high, this is a very well tractable problem. And that's what I will tell in what next 5 minutes, and I guess I'll be finishing. So basically, the less trivial part of the last part of the talk is to look how the cross-section depends on omega at omegas of order of or less than conda temperature. So what I have in my hands is small parameters. The renormalized interaction of electron with conda impurity. Energy E is large compared to TK, so this whole thing is small. And let's quickly recall how the the conventional leading log approximation is constructed, and the best way to do it is through the Anderson Spoorman scaling idea. So basically what I want to do is to calculate the sum of most divergent logarithmic terms in higher orders in production theory. And the idea to do it is the following thing. One can notice that basically the theory is renormalizable. So I can evaluate quantity A in the initial formulation with the bandwidth D. Or I can cut the band, introduce some new Hamiltonian with new parameters, which will give me the same value of A. And the equation that controls the evolution of this parameter, of induction parameter J, is here. And basically, this Hamiltonian in the reduced band, fantastically, remains identical in the form to the initial one. So that means actually that theory is renormalizable. I don't create any other terms in the Hamiltonian. So basically, it's still interaction of convection electrons with local spin, this red capital S. But the interaction J is changing upon the reduction of the band from D to D prime. Now, if I introduce quantum temperature, I can rewrite this evolution JFD prime as JFD prime is 1 over log of D prime. And the thing works as long as I stop the RG procedure at D primes larger than quantum temperature. So after I stop it, I can just use Born approximation in the constant JD prime, and that will give me this Abrikosov-Sul formula for the scattering cross-section, which happens to be purely elastic. So now what I'll do, I'll slightly modify the scheme in order to find the inelastic scattering cross-section in the leading order in 1 over log. So what I'll do is the following thing. I'll designate some strip of energies around energy E, which is well above the quantum temperature. That's where my probe electron will be living, right? So I'll have some blue guys that will be there. And then when I... And again, I would like this energy to be large compared to quantum temperature. And then when I do the Anderson's RG procedure, I will leave this part intact. So, okay, so I'll separate some small part of states which are above the Fermi level, well above, which will not be touched by the RG procedure. That will not affect the resulting Hamiltonian for the low energy excitations. But what it will do, it will allow me to introduce a Hamiltonian which will describe interaction of my probe particle, my blue electron, with localized spin. So it will be again the Kanda Hamiltonian with interaction constant J, which depends on energy chosen in the first place. So this J is a function of E, and it will be just this log renormalized quantity, but the renormalization is stopped at energy E, at energy of the probe electron. And then this red spin, the local spin, its dynamics is controlled by the Hamiltonian that acts in the narrow band D prime. So dynamics of S is controlled by the Hamiltonian, which is just quantum Hamiltonian, as we discussed in the previous transparency, with the normalized interaction constant. So that's the starting point for the calculation. As long as I look at the lowest non-vanishing order of the scattering cross-section for blue electron in J, this scheme works. Actually, one can go and calculate next order in 1 over log, but I will not talk about this. So now I mapped my problem onto a known one. And if you open a book on neutron scattering of a magnet, it will be there. So basically, my electron is like a neutron, and it scatters of a system that has some dynamics, that has some spin dynamics. So in my case, the spin dynamics is just dynamics of a single spin coupled to a bath of electrons. But the idea is the same. I can calculate the cross-section of my neutron by relating it to the spin-spin correlation function. And it's immediately clear that actually, if there's no magnetic field, there should be no elastic scattering at all, because the average value of S in the ground state is zero. It's singlet. So if average S is zero, then in the leading order, in order J squared, there should be no elastic scattering. Moreover, I can basically relate the scattering cross-section sigma of omega to the imaginary part of the speed susceptibility. And everything that I hoped to learn from literature about Kaito primes would allow me, should have been allowed me, my English is not good, to find sigma of omega. So I went to literature and tried to find what's known about Kaito primes, and actually, to our surprise, it wasn't that much that is known correctly. So the thing that was known for decades, and is absolutely right, that at low energies you have low, we have just thermoelectric behavior, and it's Kaito primes is proportional to omega. Now at high energies, actually there is fairly recent paper of Hewson, which tells that Kaito primes of omega scale at 1 over omega log squared omega, and that already allows to piece together what happens to sigma as a function of omega. So first of all, this structure factor f of omega doesn't have any delta function, okay? So it's purely inelastic scattering, but it is narrow, so the width of f is about Kanda temperature. And actually Laszlo Borda numerically did the calculation of this function. Here it is. The first linear part can be found analytically with all the prefactors that are related to Wilson number, and again the tail is perturbative. So it's a funny function because it's narrow in the sense that its width is the order of Kanda temperature, but the integral of the structure factor is barely converging. It's converging to one, but logarithmically. So in which sense the original leading log approximation is correct? It is correct in the sense that it does allow us to calculate, does allow everybody to calculate total cross section. So the total cross section for the scattering electron of an impurity, of course, was found correctly. And this is only quantity that matters in the calculation of the resistivity correction. Because basically for resistivity, we look at electrons that are living in the strip of energies of order of temperature above the Fermi level, and we don't need to know all the details about inelastic scattering cross-section. So this quantity basically is sufficient, was sufficient to calculate the resistivity, but it's not sufficient to calculate the energy loss. Now, if you apply magnetic field, then you create a non-zero value of a local spin, and that leads to a delta function in f of omega. So there is elastic contribution, inelastic contribution. If one increases field, then elastic contribution actually grows because the spin becomes more and more stiffer. It's hard to flip it. And the inelastic part actually converges to some peak around Zeeman energy if the Zeeman energy is much larger than quantum temperature. Now, I just briefly mention that basically there is a relation between two parts of the story. So I talked about scattering cross-section for two particles in the beginning, and then in the end I talked about the inelastic differential cross-section for a given electron with the system. Okay, so it's clear that in perturbation series there must be some relation, because basically I take two electrons, one is mine and another one is from Fermi C. Okay, and that should map onto the initial part of the problem, and indeed there is a relation. It's basically, again, golden rule. But the difficulty is that from the existing experiments, the incoming energies were both large compared to the Kanda temperature. And for this relation to be established, one has to look at energy of the counterpart of the scattering, small compared to Kanda temperature, and that makes things hard to compare. But again, so theoretically everything is fine, and you can actually check that these two theories agree with each other, but experimentally it's just different experiments that should be done to measure the inelastic scattering cross-section with this accuracy that I'm discussing now. So I guess that's the end of the story. Looking back, I looked at papers in 97 and I didn't realize, but it turns out that there are two papers separate by about half a year. One was killing tau phi concept, another was killing tau epsilon concept. So there was a paper, I'm pretty sure that everybody knows about this controversy, the question about whether tau phi is diverging at low temperatures. And again, I'm not in a position to judge, but I guess that conclusion that at least most people believe now is that there is no need to revise the existing theory. But with this one, with tau epsilon, apparently there is some new physics. Basically, it's not that new either, because if you just look carefully at the contour Hamiltonian, this inelastic cross-section is there. But it's fantastic that apparently it was experimentally confirmed so many decades after the original work of Kanta. Now, to finish, again, there is no any mystery in that if you go to low energies and low transferred energies, then the Fermi-Liquid behavior is restored. And this 1 over omega squared at the lowest energies should saturate at some constant value, which is back to Fermi-Liquid theory. So the conclusion is Fermi-Liquid is conventional metal is alive and well. But there is some interesting caveat. This energy was due to magnetic impurities. So I think that, you know what, maybe I also have to know that I should do. So so actually, yes, to mention my collaborator. So on energy relaxation, we worked with Kaminsky, who was my student, and this energy resolved relaxation was done in collaboration with Markus Garst, Wolfle, Laszlo Bord, and Jan van Delft, who is virtually here. There is a parallel story about the phase relaxation, which is also quite interesting. And here, in that part, I learned a lot from Anatoly Larkin, actually, that passed away, and also collaborated with our postdoc, Vavilov, and Galetsky. And also, we had very nice discussions with experimentalists listed here. And I learned a lot about actually interacting magnetic impurities from Levi Offe and Nathan Andre. So is that helpful? Thank you.
Yep. There was one item in the last transparency was talked about current noise. Did you have in mind there?
So this is actually, in hindsight, I should be talking just about current noise because this is really spintronics. So basically what we looked at is the following thing. Suppose you have two ferromagnets and a piece of metal in between with magnetic impurities. Okay, and you can polarize this way, right? So then without magnetic impurities and without spin-orbit interaction, you will have no current. And due to magnetic impurities, you'll be able to pass some current. So actually, and if you include spin-orbit interactions, then you allow to pass current, but it turns out that these magnetic impurities, you strongly affect noise. And there were some very important previous works, actually, by Mishenko, some other works that we capitalized on. So basically, it's Boltzmann equation approach, nothing fancy, but perhaps measurable.
Okay, thanks.
But still, if you have a single impurity in a barrier, forget about ferromagnetic leads, short noise would probably know about two particles getting into a section, right? Which is what you talked about.
Yes.
Something.
Okay. All right,
something is 1 over energy squared.
Thanks for the question. So again, my original motivation actually was to look at noise because Michel Devere was passing and he was telling that something should be with noise in quanta. And we discovered, well, just a few lines show you that there is nothing, you know, fancy. Basically, you have some crossover function and nothing else. And then, you know, while we were talking about that with Kaminsky, first I realized that there is much more interesting. And second, there was paper by Golub and Igal Meir, who did first just two limits for noise, Nazier and Log. But these two particle processes indeed give some peculiarities to the shapes that were recently discussed in paper of Felix van Noten and Reg, and I don't remember the third name, I'm sorry. It was quite recent paper.
I know, and
the idea was that indeed due to this multiple scattering process, you can scatter sort of more charge than...
Well, the idea was, okay, I remember this paper. The idea was that, okay, yeah, it's very low temperature, well below the quantum temperature. Uh-huh. There is still some inelastic scattering coming from this interaction,
right,
forming Nazier's Hamiltonian. Because of this inelastic scattering, the coefficient
So the coefficient is different, but
modified a little bit.
But I think it's related to the point that basically you can scatter two particles rather than one, and that was the idea. And it shows the noise because noise is sensitive how many particles you can both scatter. Yeah.
The question: how is your theory modified if spin is higher than 1/2? Because basically what you discuss here is mainly. At least it should be full compensated situation. So the question is because in the real experiment it's possible that the spin is higher than 1/2, and maybe there is some other spin situation or something like that. And the question is if in comparison with experiment mm-hmm. it could be relevant or not, or mm-hmm. it will just change with the scale of some factor, or you can expect some new behavior, for example, nano channel at the size of spin will be different.
Right.
I consider some other screens.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So there are three parts. So first of all, I mean, about the value of spin in a metal, as far as I understand it, it's a Merkle issue, and it's no, there is no full understanding what is the remaining spin. Because, I mean, on very general grounds, you would say that, okay, everything except cameras would be somehow removed. So perhaps in a host material without any special symmetry, it will be 1/2. One may think that. Now, there is no firm experimental confirmation of whether it's this way or not. This T square data at low temperatures for the resistivity, okay, you can take it as a grain of salt. So indeed, you're right that there is a possibility, though perhaps a tiny one, that spin is not 1/2. Now, whether it shows in these kind of experiments. So in the ones that exist, I believe that it should not matter because basically it's everything is at energies well above the quantum temperature, and it's in terms of RG, it's just the first loop, so it doesn't care much about the spin. Right. Now, in the theory part, which looks at the details of the inelastic scattering cross section, then indeed there will be some difference, which is theoretically easy to trace. But there are no experiments as of yet of this type at all. So I guess this is an interesting question, but it's not addressed.
There is some experiment from Grenoble, and they got some discrepancy from this Laszlo Borda and Peter Zahn result, and they think that this could be part of the data. Some higher spins and
It's Bowerly et al, right? Samanadiar and Bowerly. Yeah, I know, well, I know this paper. I mean, first of all, see, the problem is that... So what they do, they try to compare featureless curve with a featureless curve. And that is very... and the accuracy of their featureless curve is perhaps is less than the accuracy of the theoretic featureless curve, and I guess that I would be very compelled. Of course, I do know about the experiment. It's resistivity measurements. It's not this kind of energy result. So basically, you heavily average all these tiny details with DFD epsilon. Yeah, I know about the discrepancy, but I don't know whether it should be taken. At high level of dramatism.
It could be just some internal problem.
Maybe, yeah. And also, I mean, it's similar low temperatures. It's a very delicate experiment.
Yeah.
They also had an idea that maybe interaction between impurities is important a while ago, and that perhaps the Merkle Zavilla actually was to show that interaction between impurities will not solve their problems.
May not be relevant, is it? But that once you consider now magnetic impurities are correlated with like including magnetic impurities. How would that be modified in this case? Would that be relevant? I mean, of course, in the magnetic conductors are not in the quantum regime, but.
Thanks. So again, in a metal, indeed, there is Riemann-Kittel interaction between the impurities. So, and if I'm allowed another 30 seconds for detour. I don't know about glasses too much, but I was actually amazed with the following thing, that the first works on spin glasses theory works were addressing metallic glasses, and the beautiful work of Hertz. I'm not sure if they have a... Yeah, so this is taken from 1979 paper of Hertz, and I guess at least theorists recognize this Kermerkov and also Berestajdev and all things that the quantum phase transition, right? So you change the density of metric impurities, and basically what one expects that quantum temperature goes down, and then spin glass temperature emerges. This figure was in 1979 was abandoned around 80 something, and based on my knowledge, nobody returned to metallic glasses. So there's a very interesting fundamental question: how metallic spin glasses formed when you increase the density of impurities. So I didn't try to answer this fundamental question, but we thought, you know, whether one can do kind of spectroscopy, you know, just shooting high energy electrons and see whether the interaction affects affect the loss of energy. So there are some trivial things that basically you do have lots of low energy excitations in the system because you have this coupled impurities that can flip, and that enhances the elastic scattering rate for the high energy electron. So one may you just have more through the low energy spin configurations, and you can basically you can calculate the cross section of inelastic scattering due to these pairs of more complicated objects. So there are some predictions for how the energy relaxation occurs. I think that maybe I have it even somewhere. No, I don't. Here. So basically, one can see how the tail develops from an initially narrow distribution of hot electrons, and it's some dependence on energy loss, and also it depends on the impurity concentration. But we try to put numbers, and basically my understanding is that the energy loss is too fast to measure, basically. So they have a wire which is a few microns long, and for samples with very small number of magnetic impurities, they are able to see not full relaxation, but some partial relaxation. With densities at which you will have a spin glass, simultaneously the relaxation becomes so fast that perhaps you will see nothing except just Boltzmann distribution. So that's a short answer to your question. Well, not so short.
Also, in the telomere, sometimes you get situations where you're not fully when you look at rotation.
Right.
And you don't have so much like spin glass.
Yes.
Or it is also.
Yeah, I started looking at detail et al. Papers on metric semiconductors, and it's interesting, but I have nothing to say about it. Unfortunately, I didn't do much.
If you think about doing the spectroscopy experiment, you have sort of a weak deviation from equilibrium. Uh-huh. You then have to go back and start worrying again about whether the normal superconducting tunnel contacts will give a non-negligible perturbation, because they'll give deviations from equilibrium as well that usually are neglected in thinking about what the spectroscopy signals are.
You mean it's a potential probe? Or so I had the theorist consideration, but maybe it is too crude. So I thought, you know, if tunnel barrier is sufficiently thick, then it should not matter. But I don't know. On the other hand, you lose signal when barrier is thick. So that's all I can tell. I'm sorry for lack of sophistication. Yep.
Is there any distribution of quantum temperature value important for the story to make comparison with the experiment?
Yes, and. I think I understand. So, I think even I understand the origin of the question. So, for the energy relaxation, again, because it's under log, this decay is under log, it's not that important. Right. Now, in Bauer experiments, it was way more important. They really had, because it's not log, they had some power loss depending on decay. That was really way more important how the kind of temperatures are distributed. Indeed, it's true that depending on the position in the elementary cell, TK may be different. And for Pathia, I think that it wasn't very important.